Welcome to Traverse Legal Radio, the Tech Lawyer Podcast, a show dedicated to helping entrepreneurs, CEOs, and founders navigate legal issues, grow revenue, and increase their valuation. This podcast is sponsored by the IP and litigation attorneys at Traverse Legal PLC. Visit traverselegal.com to learn how Traverse Legal's attorneys are changing the way law is practiced. Now, here's your host, trial attorney Enrico Schaefer.
Welcome to Tech Law Radio. My name is Enrico Schaefer. I'm an attorney with Traverse Legal, and we specialize in complex litigation and focus on intellectual property cases such as trademark infringement, copyright infringement, trade dress, trade secret infringement, and theft. These types of issues typically take us into federal court, where we handle a lot of litigation for a lot of clients. And so today I wanted to talk about something that comes up all the time in our litigation practice, and it's third-party subpoenas in federal court. Now, the reason why I want to talk about this today is because I think it is one area of legal practice that is one of the least understood and one of the areas where lawyers can really win a case, and yet they often fail to do the things necessary in order to get the third-party information that can win the case. And this becomes especially true in internet and technology cases where you're dealing with third-party providers of online services, the Facebooks, the Apples, the Googles, the GoDaddies of the world. These are the folks that you're going to want to subpoena in a lot of online infringement cases. And they have got a whole set of special rules that they abide by. They've got their internal policies that they abide by. And at the end of the day, they make it really challenging to actually get the information that you're looking for. So today on the show, we have litigation attorney Mallory King, and Mallory has got a lot of experience in issuing subpoenas to third-party service providers in the internet space, and so she's going to help us out today by helping you understand how to go about a third-party subpoena to an Apple or an Amazon or a Google or a GoDaddy or another internet service provider, how to actually get the information that you're looking for. So we're really excited to have Mallory on the show today because we think this is going to be a really high-value show for our listeners. And again, we like to thank our listeners who tend to be other attorneys, law professors, law students, and clients who are frankly interested in learning more about how to win their case and go to the internet and search for information about specific legal issues that they're dealing with, and specific issues that they might be dealing with in litigation that their attorneys are handling, such as how to subpoena Amazon or how to subpoena Google. So, Mallory King, welcome to the show today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show again, Enrico. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so Mallory, you know, we really like to help our listeners out and help other attorneys understand how to navigate internet and technology issues when it comes to litigation and other matters. So today, we're gonna lift up our dress and we're gonna let people see how we go about getting third-party information from internet service providers, and hopefully this will help our listeners get the data that they want to try and get from some of these third-party providers in their federal litigation cases. So welcome to the show. Let's talk a little bit about what is a third-party subpoena. Can you explain a little bit, give us some context about what a third-party subpoena is in the context of federal court litigation?
Absolutely. So the federal rules do provide for third-party subpoenas in Rule 45. So this allows for subpoenaing third parties that aren't a party to the litigation, you know, like Google and Amazon and GoDaddy, like we were discussing. And so you could acquire electronically stored information. So people can use these Rule 45 subpoenas to try to get more information about, well, we would assume the defendant, since we typically do the plaintiff side cases in these situations. But this information can be so incredibly valuable to your intellectual property and cyber squatting claims. For instance, if you're subpoenaing GoDaddy as a registrar, they could have account information related to ownership of the domain name that is subject to cyber squatting. Amazon and Apple could have information regarding products that are sold on their platforms that are infringing intellectual property. PayPal can give you logs of money in and out of a defendant's account, so you can kind of get an idea of the profits they're getting from intellectual property infringement. And Google, you know, obviously Gmail, who doesn't have one of those? That email content there can be invaluable with additional information about infringement and cyber squatting, who the defendant was communicating with. You know, maybe they were soliciting sale of a particular domain name to establish bad faith. The grounds for information that is discoverable is really you know, unlimited here, and it's so difficult to acquire, and so that's why I'm really excited to talk with listeners about how you can get as much information as possible from these third parties.
What we typically see, Mallory, is, you know, is other lawyers and other law firms will often issue a subpoena because they know how to do that, right? They know how to issue a Rule 45 subpoena, but they're used to doing it to someone's employer or some offline company that has got a system for providing, you know, a lot of times paper, sometimes digital copies of paper. It's just different when you're going after information that's being hosted or stored, data that's being stored by a third-party service provider. It's much more challenging. And what we tend to see is that the attorney or the lawyer issues the subpoena. Apple, Amazon, Google, GoDaddy, PayPal, whoever, they respond and they don't end up providing much of any information, and they have a bunch of objections that they make, and the lawyers tend to kind of go away at that point, and they don't get what they're looking for. They're not sure how to proceed, and they end up really falling short of their goal of getting that objective third party information that the other party can't lie about. So let's just kind of start and work through the process here before we get to like how to deal with some of the barriers that some of these third parties put up in order to try and make it difficult. And maybe that's not their intent, but they do have a process and you do have to jump through the hoops if you want to get through their subpoena process. But let's just start with the basics. You know, how do you draft a meaningful subpoena to a third party internet provider?
Well, overall, your strategy needs to be focused on the specifics. Specificity is of ultimate importance here. They don't want broad requests. They don't want vague requests. They want to know exactly what you're asking for, and essentially they're going to want to know why, but we'll get to that later when we talk about objections. So, you know, our strategy is usually that you need to make sure you're asking for information within a reasonable date range. You know, you want to make sure you're covering, of course, the time frame relevant to the case at hand, but if you're asking for 20 years worth of information, they're going to be completely turned off by that. You need to be realistic. And plus, a lot of them have data retention policies where certain data isn't even in existence anymore outside a certain date range. So you want to try to limit that as much as possible. And you also want to give as much information about the account holder as possible. So, for instance, if you're trying to acquire information about what the defendant in a case is doing on a particular online website, you want to give the name, their potential email, their physical address, any information that you have that could potentially be associated with that company's account for that holder, you give it to them. And this goes also for like links to specific websites and products at issue. You know, for instance, I've had Amazon and Apple both tell me putting that link to that product in the subpoena was what sealed the deal for us. We were able to, you know, find that for you. Or putting that link to that iTunes, Apple App Store account storefront is what helped us know exactly where to look. They want this to be as easy as possible for them. And so the more you can give them to help them track down the information, the more likely they're going to work with you. And one last thing to consider, if you're looking for email content, a good strategy is to include keywords that you're looking for, you know, for instance, your client's trademark or other relevant terms to your litigation. But some companies like Google won't even filter via email, so it all really depends. But it never hurts to put them in to show that you're trying to limit what you're requesting and not asking for like a data dump. So those are kind of the high-level best practices when drafting those.
So when we're working with other attorneys who are looking for expertise on third-party subpoena help, right? And so they come to us because we understand internet and technology. We understand how these third-party providers work. And so we can help these attorneys with their subpoena process. And one of the first things that happens is the question, like, what exactly are you looking for? And you mentioned it as the very first bullet point, which is specificity is important. It really also comes down to you have to be strategic. The third-party providers do not respond very well to fishing expeditions.
Exactly.
And if you should, as a lawyer in litigation, have a pretty good guess as to what it is you think you're going to find or what exactly you are looking for using the third-party subpoena process. And so rather than just drafting a broad subpoena that's everything in the kitchen sink and is just going to annoy the third-party service provider, what we advise to both our clients and to other attorneys who retain us to help with these issues is, you know, really let's be strategic. Let's dig into what it is that we think we're trying to accomplish, and then what we already understand what the data fields are within these platforms and how account information is kept. So it's easy for us to use the right terminology, I guess is my point. If you're just looking for documents and documents are defined as everything tangible and intangible, you know, that's much more challenging. If you're able to narrow down on exactly what you're after and you use the right terminology, you're going to have a much easier time working with the third party provider. So let's talk a little bit about the kind of the drafting strategy. So what are your kind of recommendations as to how to go about getting that drafted with the specificity that you talk about, with the level of information that's gonna, you know, get you the coordination and cooperation you're looking for from the third party provider?
Well, what we've done in the past on cases where we're looking for this information is that it's kind of like you go from broad to narrow. So you would be like, defendant is known to have an account with you. Defendant may go by this name. Defendant may be using this email address in association with their account. If there's several, put all of them. They may have this physical address hooked up to their account. If there's several, list them. The product is located at this link. Put it in the subpoena. Put as much information in there as possible. And, you know, something too, after sending these subpoenas, if you get a response, which again, we'll talk about the objections in a bit, but a lot of them wanted to more insight into the procedural posture of the case. You know, where are you in discovery? What's going on? Why are you asking for this now? And so, you know, also considering, you know, putting and maybe some background information about why you're looking for this could even push it further to avoid more hiccups down the road.
Yeah, because what these third-party providers are very sensitive to is if someone goes to a court and they start using the court process for what at least the third-party provider might believe is inappropriate use of court process. And so why are you trying to get this? Well, someone stole my, you know, copyright-protected products and enlisted them at Amazon. That's a good answer. Amazon understands that. They don't want that. They're much more psychologically tuned in to trying to want to help you on that. But if it's, oh, well, here's a competitor and they're underselling our price and you can't really say that you've got a claim, but you were able to file a lawsuit and then that gave you subpoena power, right? They get to decide how much they're going to fight you, which really brings us to the next thing I want to talk about, Mallory. You send out the subpoena. It's well drafted. You get they ask for an extension to respond to the subpoena, but eventually you get the responsive document and inevitably it contains objections. Tell us a little bit about what we would expect in terms of objections from third-party service providers.
Well, yeah, like you said, it's essentially guaranteed that they're going to respond with more than one objection. They probably have template letters, you know, waiting at the ready to send out to people who send subpoenas to them, because they never want to give it up until they know absolutely for certain that it's legally sound and that they're able to, you know, provide you with that information. So one of the biggest ones we see, and this is especially when you're asking for email content, is Stored Communications Act objections. And so this prohibits entities that provide electronic communication services from divulging contents of communications that are in their electronic storage. So this is a big one for Gmail, or if you're asking for emails, you know, from GoDaddy related to an account holder's account. They, you know, could be liable under this act if they divulge information that they are not allowed to. And so they're very, very cautious. They will almost always want consent from the account holder before releasing this information. And so it's really important to either come with that consent or anticipate that you may have to work around that consent. Another one that is really big is relevancy. And, you know, companies may want it spelled out exactly how the requests in your subpoena are relevant to the claims or defenses in litigation. So, for instance, Apple sends us an objection letter. They like to see a letter back that literally breaks down every single objection and explains why you think the objection is meritless and why you think the information is relevant. And so this is copying and pasting complaint allegations or answer, you know, responses, attaching documents so that they can see, okay, we're alleging that they've uploaded this copyrighted information onto Apple iTunes. Here is the product screenshot on Apple iTunes, and that's why it's relevant to our copyright infringement claim. So you need to break it down, and then after that, you talk to them on the phone, and they're willing to work with you. They just want to see that you're willing to put the effort in. And let's see, another one that's very very common is undue burden. These companies consider these subpoenas to be expensive and laborious. They don't want to go searching deep into the archives. Potentially, it's archaic technology that they no longer even utilize that you're asking for information of. And so, and this burden is on them. So you need to just reiterate to them, be like, hey, show me why this is so hard for you to do. You know, they're big companies. They should have the staff at hand to respond to these types of subpoenas. You're certainly not the only subpoena receiving. So you just have to push them. And something else to consider is their confidential business information. Again, like Apple has a lot of proprietary information that they may disclose pursuant to a subpoena response, and they would prefer the general public not to know about it. So if you could have a protective order already in place in your litigation, anticipating that sensitive information might be forthcoming, that's great. You can be like, hey, we already have one. Don't, no problem. Don't have to do that, you know? So just, you know, really some things to think about. And the last one I would say, which is really silly, and if anyone gives up because of this one, you should think differently, is the designated place for compliance. The federal rules say that technically people and companies don't have to produce documents that are more than 100 miles away from their place of business. And so, you know, we're located in Michigan. We get California companies throwing in this objection all the time. Like, well, that's way further than 100 miles. We shouldn't have to provide that to you. Well, the committee notes for Rule 45 have already addressed this and said, given the digital age that and the electronic exchange of production and discovery information, that that rule really is worked around a lot, you know, and so you just reiterate to them, be like, hey, we're not asking you to send us physical documents. In fact, we prefer you didn't. And we're not asking for anyone to physically show up and hand deliver them. Just send them to us in a CD, send them to us in a zip drive. Electronic is the way to go. So you can get around that 100-mile objection, no problem.
So that is, you know, that is great, Mallory, because it really gives a great overview and synopsis of what you're going to see in almost every third-party subpoena response. There's a whole list of objections. Maybe they give you some, they're very good at giving you just enough information to be able to make it look like they sent something, but none of the stuff you're looking for, none of the good stuff that is going to win your case in litigation, right?
The first
one that you mentioned, I think it deserves a little special attention. It's the Stored Communications Act, or SCA, and it's 18 U.S.C. 2701, et cetera. And it basically creates penalties for anyone that assesses information, digital information, electronic information that's stored through or with an ISP. And it's a legitimate objection that you will see by third-party providers. So they are special federal laws that protect all of our digital information when it's stored in the cloud or it's stored on the servers of an ISP, internet service provider. So they use this as a way to avoid providing documents and creating potential liability. But there are ways around the Stored Communications Act objection, and one of which is a subpoena, right? If a court orders that documents be produced, then there's no way for the ISP to get in trouble. Where it gets to be an issue is, does the ISP, does the service provider, social media provider, et cetera, have to respond to the subpoena with the SCA stored communications objection and then have a follow-up order from the court saying, no, that's fine, you need to provide it, I've already reviewed the matter and I find it relevant? Or is a subpoena enough to trigger the production? And of course, not all third parties treat this issue the same. The point is this: the SCA is a common objection which stops a lot of people in their tracks. They don't understand the Stored Communications Act. They look it up. It looks legitimate. Oh, no, I can't get this information. And they simply walk away from their subpoena. What I want to ask you is, what happens next after you get this minimal production and a litany of objections from the internet service provider?
Well, I would just emphasize that persistence is key. So if you're, you know, dissatisfied with the amount they've given you, or they've just given you a letter alone with nothing else, just keep working with them. You know, they're willing to work. These attorneys are willing to work with you to overcome their concerns, and they're often willing to compromise, you know, on narrowing the scope of your subpoena to make responding more practical for them. And so this could mean some companies will take, you know, we've issued signed consents, pretty general contracts where the defendant has signed their consent, and we've provided that to some, and that's been sufficient, you know, for Apple, along with the signed consent and with our responses to their objections and with several phone calls with Apple's counsel narrowing our scope, they finally provided us with information. And so, but this was over several months of communications back and forth with their attorney. And so this isn't going to be a 1 week and done thing, because once they've agreed to produce it, guess what? It's going to be another month or so before they actually give it to you. So, I just want to emphasize the persistence on that really is so important.
Let me ask you a question about the signed consent, because presumably I'm a plaintiff. I'm suing for trademark or copyright infringement. The defendant is my adversary and their counsel isn't going to want to cooperate with me at all. And I get Apple saying, well, we can't give you that without consent, or Gmail saying we cannot give that to you without consent or court order, is usually the way it's phrased, consent or a specific court order, right?
Yeah.
One of the ways, though, is to get the defendant to consent. And, you know, for our listeners, you shouldn't expect that that's going to be something that you're going to send to the other attorney and they're simply going to have their client sign. Context is key here. Sometimes there's already been motion practice and it's clear that the court is ordering that the subpoena be allowed and go forward. Sometimes there's objections to the subpoena, motion to quash that have been filed and ruled on, which essentially tell the defendant, you need to consent. Do whatever is necessary to work with the plaintiff to get the information. And so the court has either explicitly or implicitly told the other party to sign whatever consent the third party service provider requires in order to get the information. And so that's, you've seen that work in the past, correct?
Yes, I have. And like you said, it varies across which third party company you're dealing with. You know, the court is in a position to actually order a defendant to consent. So there's case law out there that says, you know, court ordered consent is valid under the Stored Communications Act. And so if you have, like we have before, you have a court order that says defendant sign X, Y, and Z subpoenas for these third parties, he signs them. And then we provide those companies with the signed consent and the court order that says he was meant to sign them. You know, yes, there are the exceptions where you have an amicable defendant, which is like almost an oxymoron, but they'll sign the consent voluntarily. But, you know, Google, for instance, takes this whole process another step further. Google, you know, won't just take a signed consent at face value. They want a specifically drafted court order, which if you work with Google's general counsel, they will give you an example court order and be like, this is how we like to see it stylized. If you have any questions, send it back to us. Send us the draft back to us and we'll review it before you file it so that we know for sure we can comply. Because the worst thing you want to do is think you have a court order, go through the whole rigmarole and have Google be like, sorry, it's still not okay. So after you get a court order for Google, they have a consent verification process. So this process entails the defendant emailing Google from the email address at issue in the subpoena or from the various email addresses at issue in the subpoena and attaching the court order that is, you know, either ordering their consent or, you know, involuntary or voluntarily. You attach that court order to the email and then the defendant sends it to Google. And then that way Google knows it's the actual person consenting to the production of email. And then there's a court order attached to it. So, you know, and so that requires a whole nother level of consideration on making sure the court order is drafted correctly, making sure, you know, the defendant follows through on his end of the court ordered, you know, bargain. So there's an extra layer. And it's different across all boards. And so it's, you know, a lot of experimentation is needed. But if you really want to know the answers, they can always ask us.
Yeah, that's true enough because we've been through it enough times. And, you know, this, of course, all assumes that the defendant is the subject of the subpoena. Sometimes there will be an anonymous defendant, a John Doe, a Jane Doe, or a third party account holder that's not a party to the suit, in which case you're not going to get consent, but you are going to need to get court orders. And you might have the third party provider file their own motion to quash. You might have the defendant file motion to quash. The third party provider might give notice to the account holder so they have an opportunity to file a motion to quash. And so there's a whole motion practice side to this whole thing that can go in lots of different directions. The main point being, none of this is quick. You need to get started on subpoenas early if you're going to be subpoenaing tech companies, and you need to be willing to work for what you get. Perhaps the hardest thing in discovery are your third-party tech subpoenas. They take the longest. If you're just issuing a request for production of the defendant, they don't respond, you'll get a motion to compel, it's ordered, they gotta give it to you. That's not how third-party subpoenas work in the internet age, unfortunately. And so you're going to need a cooperative judge, too. And you, best thing I can advise is when we have these third-party subpoenas with the cases that we're involved in, we advise the court right out of the gate how difficult this is going to be, that it's going to be a process, that it's going to take time, and that we want to get started early. And then that way you're not coming back to the court and the court's going, well, that was 4 months ago. Why don't you have the records yet? And the answer could be a very legitimate, we've been working our butts off and you still don't have the records. So you need to understand all of these different things if you want to work your way through this process and get where you need to get to. So, Mallory, let's just kind of wrap, and there's a lot more we could talk about on third-party subpoenas, right? But this has been a great start for our listeners today who are interested in this issue. And, of course, they can contact Mallory King at traverslegal.com if they have any questions. We're always willing to help. And, obviously, we do work with other law firms on the subpoena issue since we have that expertise. Give us your high-level tips for attorney that's looking to issue a third-party subpoena to a tech company.
Okay, absolutely. So I have five overall tips that if you're going on this adventure of third-party subpoenas, definitely take heed. First, be specific. Like I said, include as much information as possible in your subpoena. Be persistent. It isn't over after the receipt of objections. In fact, you've only just begun. Be flexible with the information you've requested. If you can compromise on certain aspects, for instance, narrowing the date range, do it. Some information is better than none. Be gracious with the individuals helping you. These are other attorneys on the other side representing these tech companies, and kindness can go a lot further than being aggressive or demanding. They're more likely to help you if you have a good repertoire with them. And lastly, be realistic. The chances that you're going to get every single piece of information you requested is very slim. And this could either be because the tech company's retention period is expired or that information never existed in the first place. So if you're not getting every single piece of information, that's probably an accurate representation of what the information they have. So that would be all I would recommend in general.
That's great. Mallory King, thank you so much today for your insights on third-party tech subpoenas. I think it is an area that we're going to continue to see grow more and more complex. You obviously have GDPR issues that are going to work their way into these things when you happen to have folks located in the EU. You've got data that used to be available that is now not available publicly, and you've got deletion requests going on from the EU citizens that just simply removes data at their request from any third-party provider. So as we look at these data discovery issues and the preservation of data, the storage of data, and the discovery of data, expertise is going to become the number one differentiator between success and failure in litigation. That's it today for Tech Law Radio. Thank you so much for joining us. To all our lawyer friends and law professor friends, law student friends, and of course clients who follow along, we encourage you to share this show and to tell other people about it and increase the following. We will continue to bring you great content, and until next time, have a great day.
You've been listening to the Tech Lawyer Podcast, sponsored by Traverse Legal PLC, a law firm representing clients like you on matters just like yours. You can find the Tech Lawyer Podcast on most podcast listening platforms, including your home devices. Until next time, remember that good attorneys win for their clients. Great attorneys tell you up front how they're going to do it and how much it will cost.